certainly, I would say it's true from my experience of the festival that the local films draw much bigger crowds than the international content. For example, there were at least 200 to 300 people in the audience for another Egyptian film called The Other Land. The trailer for this film, when it launched on YouTube, reached more than a million viewers in just 1 week after appearing online. The story of the film is based on a true news story, very well known here in Egypt, about a group of young Egyptian men who are fleeing impoverished conditions or rural villages with few prospects, and they travel illegally by sea to go to Italy. So it's a story of people smugglers, which is only too familiar in the current, you know, refugee climate, where we're seeing so many people risk their lives for the chance at a better life.
The film critic Tara Judah at the Cairo International Film Festival. We'll join her there soon on this round-the-world edition of The Cinema Show, also on the program.
As I step into the classically styled space, lined with ornate columns and filled with tables and chairs, it feels like I'm stepping back in time.
Touching down in Spain, we'll visit one of Europe's most beautiful picture palaces, the Cinedore. Plus,
maybe 80% of our work is make interesting voices hearable and visible. We put together short film programs, but the films don't necessarily have to be short films. We also show longer films.
Austria has produced some of history's most celebrated filmmakers. We'll pay a visit to a place dedicated to nurturing the talent of tomorrow. We'll also see how the London of the real world compares to the city seen in the movies, and a final word from everyone's least favourite disgruntled critic. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Welcome to the programme, I'm Ben Rylan. We'll set off on our international tour in just a moment, but first, being in London, it makes sense that we start this week's show with a closer look at this fine city. We're all fairly familiar with the London scene on the screen, whether it's a frantic Doris Day running all over town in search of her kidnapped child in Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much, or Hugh Grant spilling orange juice all over the front of a furious Julia Roberts. But when strolling around the real London, it can be easy to feel rather distanced from that quaint, romantic vision. Here's Monocle's Andrew Miller taking us for a walk as he ponders that gap between city and screen.
The camera loves London. Why would it not? Its iconography and mythology are familiar the world over. Its historical gravitas is unsurpassed. Politically and culturally, London has been the de facto capital of the world for centuries. London boasts every variety of urban environment one might conceivably envisage as a backdrop, from slums to terraces to parks to palaces, and every variety of character a screenwriter might imagine, including American werewolves and Peruvian bears, can be plausibly cast as a Londoner. Yet very rarely in London does one get that feeling that one so often does in New York City, that one is strolling around a movie set of creaking fire escapes and steaming sidewalks, braced vaguely for Martin Scorsese to yell, "Cut." London's character is more amorphous, more diffuse. This may be why one never sees London as Londoners see it on the big screen, and recalling cinematic representations of the city, it's probably just as well. The modern movie version of London is largely defined by the works of Richard Curtis and other films which aspire to Richard Curtis-ism. Films, that is, which star Hugh Grant, or might as well. The likes of Notting Hill, Sliding Doors, and the execrable Bridget Jones franchise are a vision of London which caters to the sentimental delusions of uninformed rubes with a twee, fanciful, and altogether unrealistic idea of the city. Like Americans, or the Evening Standard. In these films, everybody works in the media and enjoys generous accommodations in glamorous parts of town, despite working in the media. Everybody is somewhat posh and altogether white. This, in fairness, is no less preposterous than the occasional depictions of London as a brutal dystopia. London, despite the size, diversity, and density of its citizenry, is a remarkably safe city. It is far from unlikely that one might see people dressed at least as stupidly as Alex and his fellow droogs from A Clockwork Orange on one's commute, but Londoners would barely arch an eyebrow, much less consider fleeing in terror. The other most heartily caned cinematic stereotypes of Londoners are either ducking, diving petty crooks, as in The Long Good Friday, The Lavender Hill Mob and The Italian Job, or bumptious, sharp-suited, swinging London types, as populate the likes of Blow Up, Modesty Blaze, Performance or Alfie. Both varieties of Londoner do exist, though not in substantial numbers, and both are therefore mercifully easily avoided. All things considered, then, probably the most accurate depiction of London and Londoners ever committed to celluloid is Bruce Robinson's With Nail and Eye. With Nail and Eye acknowledges London's squalor, its struggle, and its stresses. It appreciates the degree to which these can occasionally prompt Londoners to wonder why they put up with it, and to consider relocating, whether permanently or temporarily, somewhere more restful. And it understands that, on average, a weekend anywhere else is about as long as it takes to realise that you really shouldn't have left. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, the cinema show's private flight is ready for boarding, so please take a seat, fasten your seatbelt, and get ready to touch down in a place adored for its rich cultural scene. Madrid, the beautiful Spanish capital, home to more magnificent museums and amazing architecture that you could ever fit into a single trip. But while all that sounds tempting, we're here to catch a film. The near-century-old Cinedore is the shining jewel in the Spanish Culture Ministry's Filmoteca, an impressive national archive of global stories committed to celluloid. Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous takes us on a journey that shows that the golden age of cinema is still alive and well inside this little film house.
Each day, a small crowd gathers at the street-side box office to get their ticket to one of the world's most picturesque cinemas. The murmuring crowd gathered in front of the whimsically painted tangerine and cream-coloured façade begins filing into the equally magical foyer before the feature presentation. As I step into the classically styled space, lined with ornate columns and filled with tables and chairs, it feels like I'm stepping back in time. There's a bar in the far corner serving small Spanish-flavoured tapas, beer and wine, while a cosy shop sits on the other side selling beloved film books and what now seem like vintage DVDs. Tonight's film is Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, a fitting film to show off the diversity of cinema on show here. The monthly program is packed with old Spanish adventures, Hollywood classics, and world cinema from Kazakhstan to the Czech Republic, all of which are shown in their original version and projected on their original film reels. Every one is carefully selected from the Spanish Cultural Ministry's treasure trove of film stock. The foyer's walls, lined with framed vintage film posters, are an homage to the Spanish component of this archive. From Carlos Saura's Garden of Unearthly Delights, to Viridiana by Luis Buñuel, Almodóvar's Ley de Deseo, and I even spot one poster in the corner for a 1947 production of Don Quixote. Since it was first built in 1912, the life of Cinedore has reflected that of the city, and its ups and downs feel like a long-running formulaic film franchise. After the ambitious and more commercial first outing, the entire cinema was given the remake treatment, reopening in 1923 with a more refined artistic direction. the sequel was more successful than the original because the decorative elements from the floor to the ceilings were a spectacle in themselves, evoking cinema's golden era at every turn. However, as the years ticked by, the gradual creep of commercialism cheapened the acclaim. By the 1950s, it had become known as the Sala de las Pipas because of the sunflower seed crunching working classes it attracted for cheap matinee sessions. Tonight's film, Pulp Fiction, is a far cry from the features that flashed on the big screen during the greater part of the last century. During the Franco years, censorship was rife and propaganda films ruled the billing. Eventually, weary crowds lost interest and the cinema closed down in 1963. It sat empty until 1991, when the Cultural Ministry acquired the space, restored it to its former glory, and reopened as the National Filmotheque. It's been a celebration of cinema ever since. Directors including Wes Anderson, Stanley Kubrick and Pedro Almodovar, who featured the cinema in his own film Habla con ella, are regularly afforded retrospectives. When David Lynch came to town to conduct a course on transcendental meditation, a month-long retrospective was screened in his honour, prompting the director to sneak in to watch The Elephant Man, much to the audience's delight. The famed Sala Uno, or Main Hall, enchants audiences well before the giant blue velvet curtains part and the feature film starts. From the ornately painted blue ceiling to the red-coloured private booths that line the upper balconies and the grand piano conspicuously placed up front, the entire vista transports filmgoers back to the more golden era of the silver screen. In an age of digitalized, monolithic megaplexes, a small cinema projecting original film in a perfectly preserved time capsule is a rare yet welcome aberration. And at just €2.50 a ticket, you might even be forgiven for suspending your belief, at least for a couple of hours, and genuinely feel as though you have taken your seat front and center in an increasingly bygone era of old film houses. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Thank you to Liam at the Cinedore in Madrid. Well, it's nearly time to take off for the next leg on our round-the-world trip, so while we wait for the boarding call, let's check in with our anonymous disgruntled film critic. We've been playing this series of audio snippets taken from the secretly recorded memoirs of a professional film critic at a once esteemed metropolitan newspaper. This week, our unhappy friend considers the state of today's children's films. Needless to say, he's not thrilled.
Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic, Chapter 6. Sometimes it helps to see things through a child's eyes. Upon leaving a screening of Disney's Jungle Book remake, I asked a local urchin what he thought of the film.
"It was awesome,"
he expectorated, and I nodded wisely. The child's simple, direct enthusiasm had confirmed my own suspicions that children are, in fact, cretins. As a youthful film critic, still in possession of a modicum of hope for mankind and a capacity for happiness, I rejoiced in the strict segregation that existed between adult and children's cinema. The lines of demarcation were clear. Grown-up films were sophisticated, aesthetic explorations of the human condition, posing timeless existential questions and laying bare through art the entire vista of earthly experience. On the other hand, children's films were worthless piles of diseased offal, squeezed from the fetid bowels of the industry's most self-loathing sewer lizards for the sole purpose of giving decent people an hour or two's respite from the repellent sight of the younger generation. At some point in history, presumably around the same time my column was moved from page 5 to page 38 of the paper, this satisfactory situation changed. Some leering psychopath decided it would be a good thing to make children's films that, it makes me wretch to even repeat the phrase, also appeal to adults. To me, this is a betrayal of the very purpose and foundation of the art of film. As surely as the mingling of river water and lead paint will result in a pile of dead fish, the chilling admixture of children's entertainment with that intended for functioning humans is bound to prove a massacre on the shoals of the public intelligence. I have never felt so insulted as I did during The Jungle Book. Clearly, the film was making a cringe-worthy attempt to impress me as much as it did the chirping, overgrown bacteria sharing the theatre. But I saw through its cheap tactics, its appeals to nostalgia, its sly wit, its depressing casting of Bill Murray, who, on the release of Meatballs, I tipped as a talent to watch, but who has since then squandered what potential he once had. No matter how this CGI bastardization, and incidentally I remember when directors had the balls to bring real wild animals into a studio and take their chances, no matter how it wheedled, nothing could change the fact that the script was trite. The monkeys exhibited behaviour that any amateur zoologist knows has never been observed in the wild, and Scarlett Johansson is not half the giant snake that Dame Maggie Smith would have been. It makes me fret for our future. But more than that, it makes me fret for the present. If God intended adults and children to watch the same movies, he would have made Shirley Temple sexier. And, ladies and gentlemen, he did not.
That was the final tape in our collection of stories from the disgruntled critic. No word yet on whether he'll ever finish his memoirs, but we'll let you know if we hear anything. Still to come, our international journey continues as we touch down in Austria and Egypt. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. This year, Cairo is celebrating the 38th edition of its International Film Festival. And given the recent political upset in Egypt, the art of local storytelling couldn't be more important. Monocle contributor Tara Judo is at the festival. She sent us this report about a rather baffling controversy that's had everyone at this year's event talking.
In the Last Days of the City was previously scheduled to screen in the official competition at CIFF. Now, the film had already screened at about 19 film festivals internationally, but it didn't break the festival's official rules. Still, the festival's reason for pulling his film out of competition, really quite close to the festival, given was that it had played too many other festivals internationally. It had too much exposure. But what's important about the controversy surrounding this film in The Last Days of the City is that it didn't screen in the official competition at any of the 14 other film festivals that belong to this federation called FIAPF. This is a Film Producers Association accreditation. And what that does is it stipulates that no film in official competition in one of those film festivals can screen in official competition at any other of the film festivals belonging to that same accreditation. So these are really the big film festivals. We're talking about Cannes, Venice, Berlin, Carlovivari, Locarno, etc. But in The Last Days in the City had only screened at one big name festival, really, which was Berlin, and it was not in the main competition. It screened in the forum competition at that film festival, so that wouldn't have excluded it from playing at Cairo. It also hadn't screened anywhere in Egypt, or in fact in the entire MENA region, which extends all the way from Morocco to Iran. but the film was still refused, and it came as quite a late notice after they selected the opening night film, which was also an Egyptian film, and that's a film by a filmmaker called Kamla Abu Zekri, A Day for Women. What's most disappointing, I think, is that there was no allowance for El Said's film to screen out of competition. It wasn't relegated to closing night film or even put into, there's another strand here called New Egyptian Cinema, and it wasn't entered into that strand either. There really has been quite a bit of outcry, and many artists and filmmakers, industry professionals, programmers, critics, etc., both in Egypt and elsewhere around the world, have signed petitions, and they submitted those in an attempt to get the festival to reconsider and revert its decision. Unfortunately, to no avail. Needless to say that filmmaker El Said is extremely disappointed, and he is currently on his way to the Asia Pacific Screen Awards. This film has really achieved a number of accolades and awards around the world. The film, to my Western eyes, doesn't seem to be particularly controversial. I was lucky enough to see it when it premiered in the Berlinale in February this year. I found it to be a deeply personal and sentimental piece of filmmaking. It's fictional, but has autobiographical elements, as the lead character is trying to make a film about the soul of the very complicated city of Cairo. He's doing this with the help and assistance of three friends he has, dear friends, one who lives in Beirut, one in Baghdad, and one in Berlin. And I think really that in itself is why Taymer El Said wanted it to screen in Cairo, but also why it's so deeply disappointing for him that it hasn't found its audience here. This film is a love letter to the soul of a city, and it can't screen within that city. So I think that's been really deeply disappointing and, quite honestly, a baffling decision from the festival.
Thanks to Tara Judah in Cairo. Do make sure your seatbelt is fastened nice and tight now, because we're just about to touch down for the final leg in our journey today. You may know Austrian cinema's greats like Fritz Lang, Ulrich Seidel, or Michael Haneke, but there is a new talent on the horizon. Our man in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, learns about the efforts to promote interesting new Austrian cinema.
That's an excerpt from Im Keller by Ulrich Seidel, a graphic and disturbing portrayal of the kind of stuff Austrians get up to in their basements when no one's looking. Seidel's films, like those of his fellow countryman Michael Haneke, explore the darker side of human behaviour and have helped establish Austrian cinema as perhaps the world's most depressing. But now a new generation of Austrian filmmakers has emerged that is keen to change perceptions.
The initiative started in 2011 after we have been realizing a student film festival in Salzburg for 10 years, between 2001 and 2010.
This new generation needs a little leg up, and that's what Dominik Čučer is doing. He is the founder of Cinema Next, an initiative group that helps young and up-and-coming Austrian filmmakers find their feet in an industry that can be harsh on newcomers.
Maybe 80% of our work is make interesting voices hearable and visible. So we put together short film programs, but they don't have to be, the films don't necessarily have to be short films. We also show longer films, but filmmakers that are not established yet or have not found yet the ways into the commercially working industry. So we try to help them to make themselves visible. And to connect them also with the industries, but this is something they have to do for themselves. So we help them if they need help in, I don't know, applying for funds or when they don't know how to distribute the films. And in specific cases, we also can help them with specific requests that they have.
But, you know, this, I mean, you are making a political statement almost with your work, aren't you?
Well, the political quality of that might be that many years ago there was a huge gap between, let's say, student filmmaking in Austria and the commercially working established industry. And in between those poles, there was not really anything or much that helped young filmmakers how to reach into this industry. And what we try to do with the initiatives is to break down a little bit those poles between the established industry and the very, very young one. So yes, in that sense, it can be political in the way that it helps film culture and also show that there can be a different view on Austrian cinema generally.
Are you succeeding in this?
Community-wise, I think yes. But I think it takes time and it takes more than just our initiative to do so.
I remember one thing after there was a Haneke filming competition in Cannes. We were standing together after the screening in front of the cinema with some friends from Germany, and they said, are the Austrians coming with us to have a little dinner, or are you going to commit suicide right away? You know?
This is Hans Hoch, long-time director of Austria's largest film festival, Viennale. He's been criticized in the past for neglecting homegrown talent for international entries, but this year there were many Austrian films on the program.
For me, within the frame of our festival, the Austrian films are part of the international film production, if you want. So I wouldn't say that an Austrian film is like a Danish or a Dutch film here, but still my idea is if I show an Austrian film, it should be able to compete or to be compared with an international film that is shown before or after the film. I don't like the idea of being very generous and very, you know, open to the Austrian film, because I don't think you're doing something good for these films if you just take them because they are Austrian films or because you feel you should do it. I really think that there's not the Austrian film, as there is not, you know, if you would say what is the American film? If you take our festival program, there's so different kinds of films, but at the same time, there's always something that is connected by the history, by the mentality, by where the people come from, how are they connected? You know, I think in Austria, there is within us, within our character, and within our, I don't want to judge it. I don't say that it's good or not, but there is a big ambivalence. And it would be very beautiful if you find this in the Austrian film.
Back at Cinema Next, I ask Dominik Čučer to name a few young Austrian filmmakers worth watching.
Well, it depends on the experimental sides. I, for instance, find artist Lukas Magst highly interesting. On the female side, it would be Antoinette Zwerchmeier, very young artist. On the fictional side, of course, we had this year, the big name was Patrick Vollrath with a nomination of the Short Film Oscar. He's a student from the Film Academy in Vienna, and from the Film Academy in Vienna, there are also two or three other names that I personally find very, very interesting. Maria Luz Olivares Capelle, for instance. She's of Argentinian descent, studied under Michael Haneke. Her filmic voice is also, maybe it's the South American touch that she brings into her narration, but she's definitely someone who needs to be watched. But I have been wrong also within the last couple of 6 years, so my opinion is also just one of the many, and I'm just one of the voices that speaks about Austrian cinema.
Thank you, Alexei. And that brings us to the end of this special international expedition. Coming up next week... It's our very first birthday show, and as we approach the Christmas season, we'll have a bit of a surprise in store as well. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic was written by Ben Pobgy and performed by Barney Burnham. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio, and, of course, The Cinema Show returns next week. We'll leave you now with the sounds of Marilyn Monroe wishing a happy birthday to one Mr. President Kennedy. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
For all the things you've done, the battles that you've won, the way you deal with U.S. Steel and our problems by the ton, we thank you so much.
Everybody, help!